of course, one of the big stars on The X-Files, and he's making a documentary called The Truth Is Out There.
One of the things that UFO research has done to me is instill in me a healthy disrespect for the things that government says.
They are poisoning our people. There is a population control agenda. There really are people who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world.
If we don't allow these corrupt banks to fail, then the nation will fail, and there will be no recovery.
Don't stand on the sides of the river and comment on how corrupt and dark and evil everything is. We all know that.
I don't need to have you understand or agree with me or believe. It doesn't matter to me. I know what I know.
The name of our film is?
The Truth Is Out There.
But it really isn't.
But isn't there a universal truth that science is going for?
Perhaps the universal truth is what makes us subject.
Okay, you just blew my mind.
And now, your Chilpak Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpak Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpak Hollywood Hour.
Hello there, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Nernes from Down Under.
No,
how are you?
No, you are...
Oh, I'm Dean Haglund from Down Under. That's right.
Yes, and I'm Phil Lairness from Outer Mongolia. Yeah.
I'm Dean Down Haglunder. Huh? What?
And that brings us to an end of another satisfying episode of your Chilpak Hollywood Hour.
Damn it. Oh, I should have closed with that. That's my killer closer.
Yeah. Dean Haglund, how are things down under?
Fantastic. It seems spring is in the air. It's warmed up. It's a little rainy. It feels just like Vancouver in April. And it's couldn't be more lovely.
Well, that's outstanding.
Yeah.
A lot of reactions to last week's admission on your part that Australia is trying to kill you.
Yeah, this week they didn't try to kill me so much. I saw less of the creatures, though the mosquitoes are now out with the rain. So those things are, they got some bloodlust. I'm not going to kid you.
You know, it must be something that would strike me as a very real threat for you to acknowledge it.
Well, you know what? Maybe I played it up only because I just read all sorts of things that killed people all across the country down here. And so it was all fresh in my mind. As opposed to just walking down the street, I feel absolutely at peace and no creatures trying to kill me.
As far as you know. No, it was great. It seemed like the response, and of course it was all of listeners to the show who lived down under as well. It seemed
right.
Split 50-50. And with half acknowledging that you are right, Australia is out to kill you, and the other half, you know, calling you a wimp.
Oh, damn it.
So there you go. And
well, yes, I'll buck up this week then.
Hey, let's start by remembering a celebrity who died this past week, someone I'm quite excited to hear that you knew personally. So for the next few seconds or so, let's hear Gerard Watley announce celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Thank you, Garrett Watley.
Thank you, Garrett. Yes.
Dean Haglund, you knew Yvonne Craig.
I knew her personally, yes. We sat beside each other on many a convention. She actually, first, she had a manager who I quite liked, and then that manager was retiring and connected me to Holly Evans, who now has been my sci-fi convention booking agent for some time now. And it was Yvonne Craig that introduced me to her. So that's how that goes. And she was also a big fan of the Chopac, believe it or not. She purchased one, which I personally delivered to her house in Pacific Palisades. So she was one of the early adopters of that technology.
You know, for people who are not aware of the Chopac, this was the laptop cooling device that you invented.
That's right. And went on to win a silver medal at the International Inventors Expo in Geneva, Switzerland. And I exclusively sold them at science fiction conventions. So when Yvonne saw me pitching these things and selling them off my table, she wanted one. But unfortunately, I sold out that week. I believe I was in Columbus, Ohio, if I'm not mistaken. And said, I will, you know, get you one when I get back to L.A. And which she graciously said, great. Gave me your email. And then said, yeah, come on over. Drop it off. Which I did. So
yeah, and you know, the for people who are excited about this, because this was an amazing product, I'm using one, more than one, right now, as a matter of fact. It has actually continued to keep a laptop, a PC laptop, an HP PC laptop that I have had for almost a decade, working very, very well. It's the only thing that has allowed this bad boy to survive this long. And it so it has always served two functions. It increases the longevity of the laptop, and it increased its performance. And it sounds like I'm doing a commercial, but of course the Chopac is not available. And
right, I sold the patent to another company, and they are either dragging their feet and or got confused on how to manufacture them.
Well,
so
but
I'm
this
not
is
sure.
Or how to take it to market, because this was this is why I bring this up again, and it's worth talking about every so often, and then we'll of course we'll remember Miss Craig. But you know, you invented this thing that was affordable, it was environmentally friendly, it was easy to use, and it worked, and it served an actual need on the part of laptop users. And yet you naively thought that all those things would lead to it being something that would find easy distribution in the marketplace.
Right.
What you neglected to take into consideration was the fact that so much of our economy is built on built-in obsolescence, and how dare you do something that improves the performance and especially increases the longevity of these very expensive consumer items, because this is an industry based on needing people to keep buying those every couple years.
I've foolishly misread the entire marketplace of the last 100 years of the Industrial Revolution.
But really, and this is what we've learned, right? That if there are so many good ideas that people come up with through their own ingenuity and need, and if it doesn't fit into the pre-existing parameters of both the marketing and distribution paradigms at play, good luck to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is exactly what Apple executives said to me, that, you know, hey, it's a great idea, but you're on your own. We will not do anything to help you market these things whatsoever.
And then further beyond that, there is a lot of evidence, right, that even in addition to that, they may have put on some pressure to make sure that different stores didn't carry you.
Well, yeah, because they had outstanding lawsuits regarding heat and personal injury. I won't say to what part of the body, right, but a personal injury. And because if they would then go, hey, yeah, that cooling system, that would admit to liability and they would lose all these.
If they admitted that there was a problem. That
right.
By saying that this is a potential solution to a problem, they have therefore admitted that there is actually a problem, which would then prove the merits of the case. You're right. So why do we spend all this time talking about this? Well, because we still name the show Chopac Hollywood Hour.
Absolutely.
In honor not only of the Chopac, but in honor of people's ingenuity and the solutions that people come up with for seemingly insoluble problems that affect numbers of people, and solutions that quite frankly we may not get to know about because it's business as usual. If you out there in Chopac Nation know of such a thing, write to us and let us know. We'd love to talk about it here on the show, if not in a future installment of our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, about which you heard a minute at the top of this show. You can learn more about that at truth-is-out-there.com. So Batgirl, she always, I never got to meet Yvonne Craig.
Oh.
Dean, and it wasn't just, you know, she's remembered as Batgirl, first of all, as ever. You may associate an actor with one role, but boy, someone of her chops, she did a wide array of roles and an incredible array of meaningful titles are on her resume, from Marta, who can forget Orion Slave Girl Marta in Star Trek.
That's right.
The episode Whom Gods Destroy. She played two different roles in two different feature-length theatrical releases of The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, that's right.
Including Waverly's Daughter in one
Waverly's
of those
daughter,
movies.
That's right.
She did two different Elvis movies.
That's right. In fact, I believe I have the still photograph signed by her of her in the second Elvis movie. As in my collection of autographs.
So in addition to talking about the chill pack being, you know, something that I kind of feel like I'm a standard bearer of human ingenuity, and we shouldn't let these ideas not have exposure. I also am the standard bearer for the idea that no matter how closely you identify an actor or an actress with one particular role, they are so much more than that. And if that role brought you joy, take the time to look into the other things that they did. At best, you'll discover other work that you really like, and at worst, it will simply deepen your appreciation of the role you already enjoyed.
Absolutely. What could be better?
And, you know, she was cute as a button, let's face it. And,
yes.
And really sexy. And
delightful energy, you know, the energy just being around her was fantastic.
She was so kooky isn't quite the right word, but there was an eccentricity to her performances that made her not the traditional leading lady, because looks-wise and talent-wise, she could have been a typical, prototypical leading lady. But I think, really, she was kind of a bizarre character comedienne in a leading woman's body.
Absolutely. She had what we called moxie back in the day. So that moxie came off as impish and quirky, for sure.
78 years old, she dies at, but really retires for the most part at 50.
Yeah, and doing conventions, she even retired from that. I would say 10 years ago, she stopped doing them, maybe longer. And,
I can't help but believe, you know, she was 50, probably in the early 80s then. I was told there'd be no math, right? But that makes about sense. If she died at 78, so 1980 or thereabouts, right? She turns 50 and she retires, late 70s maybe. But, you know, if she were turning 50 today, I like to think that she would have been able to stick with it, that there are more opportunities now for, first of all, her kind of eccentricity as a performer, her impishness, right, as you describe, and then there would be more roles for her to mature into now, given that kind of character quality, as opposed to the late 1970s, where you know, at that age, it's like, well, you've done your Love Boat episode.
Yeah, right.
We can get you a Fantasy Island.
And that's about it. And then the ageism really kicks in after that.
So anyway, Yvonne Craig, really a seminal part of television history, but also pop culture in the 1960s. And one of the things we did to celebrate her on our Twitter handle, at Dean and Phil, a video was posted of an early beer commercial that she did.
Yeah. That's I forgot about that. She did that. You know, she was always at the conventions. Her one piece of advice: treat the convention like a business. if you're supposed to be there at 10 a.m., show up at 10 a.m. She sat the whole day. She wasn't one of these actors just go, I'm tired or I'm not selling. I'm just going to get up and go back to my room. She was the one that treated it as a business and was very professional throughout the entire weekend, something that I adhere to now. Lesson learned from Yvonne Craig.
Last week, we said that this week would be finally the week where we begin to celebrate the movies that everyone should see that were made by female directors. And when I said this week, I mean it'll be next week when we begin that celebration.
Yeah.
Today, we talk about the movies that were seen. And, you know, I did catch up to this Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's so sad. I mean, I talked about what was wrong with it last week. You know, there is no underestimating just how much this movie was undone by casting. And, but I was struggling for quite a while to come up with, well, what would have been the alternative? I mean, as we talked about last week, Tom Cruise was attached to it.
Right.
And he would have been a much smarter call. But, you know, in going back to the idea of Robert Vaughn and David McCullum and what they brought to it. And clearly the filmmakers are no fans of the original show. They do play us the glorious Jerry Goldsmith theme song. They do set it in the 1960s. But for example, they clearly don't know what U.N.C.L.E. stands for. There is no U.N.C.L.E. in the movie until the very, very end. And they, in the dialogue for the script, they don't know what it means. So someone caught this, no doubt, at Warner Brothers, and in the end titles had to explain what it meant.
My God.
But, you know, Armie Hammer holds up better in this movie than his counterpart, Henry Cavill, as
right.
Napoleon Solo. And but, you know, Napoleon Solo needs to be iconic. I mean, people can forget this or be so young they never knew this. But here's how iconic Napoleon Solo was. He's so iconic that Han Solo was named for him.
What?
Yeah. Han Solo. Lucas gave the character the name Han Solo because of what a big deal Napoleon Solo was. So that gives you some sense of the pop culture pedigree. So this needs to be kind of a big, fun deal. But Robert Vaughn, in addition to being a mature man, a grown man, and a gifted actor, he brought such an easy, suave comedy to it. And
yes.
It's exactly that easy comedy that makes Henry Cavill's performance so lacking, because he is steamrolling through with great effort every single line. He's giving every single line so much in his effort to make it effortless.
Gravitas.
And
yeah.
No, in his effort to make it effortless, in his effort to make it tongue-in-cheek, he's giving it everything. And so I suddenly realized, and at first I thought, well, this is a ridiculous idea. Who would get sitcom stars to launch a franchise? And then I realized, well, wait a minute. Who was Chris Pratt before Guardians of the Galaxy? But
absolutely.
A sitcom actor. So I would have recommended, far more in keeping with the spirit of the original show, Adam Scott.
Adam Scott?
Yes. Is it Parks and Rec? Was that his show?
That was his show, Parks and Rec. He'd been on that as the love interest, I believe, to what's her face now?
Yeah, but that's what makes it perfect. So his background is in comedy, but he is a bona
leading
fide romantic lead. So you could believe him as a romantic lead. You could believe him as a womanizer. He's got the kind of besuited look for 1960s tailoring that's perfect. You could believe him to be both a spy and a clothes horse while still, you know, like I said, the romantic lead. And then, although I said Armie Hammer holds his own, you know, he's a mountain of a man, and they've re-envisioned Ilya Kuryakin in this movie. Whereas what made Kuryakin so great was what a badass he is while being diminutive.
Right.
And so he snuck up on you. And I actually would much more prefer, again, someone with more of a comedic background. And if he can do the Russian accent, I would go in the direction of Joel McHale from Community,
wow.
who, of course, has joined the cast of the X-Files revival.
I know. He's got a little three-episode arc in there, that fella. Joel McHale, you know, I am stuck with him being the host of The Soup, of course. So it's hard for me to get past that to see him in any other thing. So I'm looking forward to seeing him on The X-Files. But to recast him in Man from U.N.C.L.E., I'm just tearing that through my head. And with the Russian accent, I can't see it.
Well, I would certainly go someone in that direction and really go towards having them be a supporting. I think clearly we know that in this Man from U.N.C.L.E., one of the reasons that it doesn't work, one of the many reasons, even though there's some really delightful stuff in there, but one of the reasons it doesn't work is clearly there must have been rewriting going on after Tom Cruise drops out, because Tom Cruise would be your leading man. Suddenly he's replaced by Henry Cavill, and now you have a split protagonist. Now Ilya Kuryakin is every bit the equal in, and some would say that's the way it should be, but I guarantee you that's not the way they envisioned it when they had Tom Cruise on board till the 11th hour. So if we assume that the original script did follow Solo with Kuryakin a supporting player, then I think you have some exciting possibilities at that point. Now, what they did get right was Hugh Grant as Commander Waverly, who will become in charge of U.N.C.L.E. And indeed, it's the one thing that brought me both joy and sadness at the end of the movie, where he's basically announcing that they're getting to stay together as a team and they have a new assignment. And I'm thinking, great, okay, we're finally getting started. Of course, it's such a financial bomb, this movie, that there never will be a follow-up. But he is so delightful in it. And at times, it almost made me wish, well, quite frankly, why didn't we just go back and start over with him playing Napoleon Solo?
Well, there's a good question.
Because he is too old.
Is he too old?
Though Cavill's too young. He is too young because this is someone who supposedly has a record during World War II, is an officer, and then here we are 18 years after the end of World War II. And I didn't buy Cavill being that old, but... anyway, but because the thing about Hugh Grant in these movies is he's so innately entertaining.
Right.
And an actor needs to bring something like that to these films, which is why Chris Pratt has, to the surprise of some, made such a big mark in these studio tentpole movies, because he brings an innate entertainment value to them.
Absolutely. There's a sense of joy in just being there. Regardless of what sort of emotional arc his character is going through, you see that the actor actually enjoys being in the movie.
Wow. I'm so glad you brought this up, because I've been watching the first episode of the Patrick Stewart series, Blunt Talk on Stars.
Yeah.
Now, this is produced by Seth MacFarlane and created by Jonathan Ames, whose most recent foray into television was Bored to Death. And it's getting terrible reviews. And in watching the pilot, I understood why it's getting terrible reviews. But I enjoyed the pilot enough to say I'm going to keep watching some of these episodes because of the elan, the just absolute effervescent joy that Patrick Stewart brings to his performance. Now, he's playing a man who is joyless, might even be in depression, might be entering dementia, but the performer is bringing such joy to this work, and that rubs off.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can feel it?
You can absolutely feel the joy that the actor has, even when he's playing some really dark stuff. You know, and that's like we talk about. You know, it's... You can't be bored to play someone who's bored.
Right.
Don't meet depression with depression.
Right. You have to find that which bores you and be interested in playing that.
Yeah.
That's the whole trick.
So
and that's difficult.
Having Hugh Grant in this Man from U.N.C.L.E. thing is just it's something they got so right. It makes you wish they got more. right. And how about what to make of this Hugh Grant? You know, here's a man who a few years ago turns down, walks away from a guaranteed $100 million for two years of work on Two and a Half Men. He gives that role up to Ashton Kutcher instead. You know, and obviously part of it was he didn't want to work with the people that, that he met. But I mean, it's $100 million. You know, those are golden handcuffs. And
they are.
But clearly, that just didn't matter to his own personal relevancy, right? And so here he is instead taking supporting roles in franchise movies or failed franchise movies and doing straight to like VOD films. And so it's an interesting choice and a hard one really to wrap one's mind around, given that he was an A-list star. But good for him, I guess.
But good for him. I think good for him. I think regardless of what movies he's doing and straight to VOD stuff, I think that being the after Charlie Sheen and you're not going to get the rating numbers and all of that sort of thing would have been further diminished. Ashton Kutcher, he's not going to get the numbers Charlie Sheen ever got in terms of ratings. And so it's not going to affect his career. Because, you know, he wasn't leading man in movies material, yet Hugh Grant was. And I think that would have been a bigger dent for his long run, regardless of how much money they were throwing at him for a two-year stint. So I think he did the right thing, and I salute him for that.
I just think, you know, that $100 million he could have financed on his own out of his pocket the 10 movies I've written for him to star in.
Well, I'll send him an email.
The big hit, the big runaway smash hit right now here in the tail end of summer of 2015 in the U.S. And by the way, you know, there, a lot is being made of how the box office year in, year out at the end of August is just year to year dropping off a precipice at the end of August. And I think the industry is finally beginning to understand it's because here in the U.S., kids are going back to school earlier and earlier each year.
Right. Yeah, they changed the timing on that.
So, you know, already a quarter of colleges are back and 40% or more of K through 12 were back this weekend. And so the box office just plummeted. But number one still is Straight Outta Compton, this huge, huge hit that tells the story of NWA. And it's produced by and shepherded by original NWA members Ice Cube and Dr. Dre.
Of course,
Ice Cube is played by his son O'Shea Jackson, who's getting rave reviews for, quite honestly, looking just like his dad.
Well, that's some smart casting right there.
But there is a star, if there's any justice in this world, a star-making performance. In fact, although the guy's only 28 years old and African-American, I would much rather have seen him get cast as Napoleon Solo in Man From U.N.C.L.E. This kid named Jason Mitchell, who plays Eazy-E, he had done a handful of bit parts, glorified extra work on movies that shot in New Orleans, where he's from. Apparently, he was recommended for the auditions by a well-respected acting teacher there in New Orleans. And his performance as Eazy-E, from the moment he shows up on screen, it's a performance by an actor who already has mastered it, who knows himself at 28 years of age, and it is a riveting movie star performance as well.
Wow. That sounds impressive.
It is absolutely worth seeing the movie. The first hour of this movie, Straight Out of Compton, is terrific. It's a 2 hour and 30 minute movie. The second hour devolves into all the tropes of music biopic movies that befall every single one of these movies. And one could say, well, they are all true that you know, all these stories, these real life people succumb to the cliches of the music business, which begs the question, did none of these young people, be it Beach Boys, like, you know, Brian Wilson from Love and Mercy, Or Frankie Valli of the Jersey Boys, or Eazy-E, Dr. Dre, and Ice Cube of N.W.A. Did none of these people see music biopics when they were growing up to avoid the cliched pitfalls in real life? So it really does get bogged down in that. It regains itself in the final half hour. So in what is to me a inherently flawed genre because of this, because of the tropes, right, because of the cliches. You know, honestly, if a musical act avoided these cliches, they may become stars, but I doubt a biopic gets made of them.
Well, exactly. Who wants to see that story of them? Hey, I recorded music. It went very well. I believe that would be the story of Arcade Fire from Montreal or something like that, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Nice guys. Make a band. Make a lot of music. Make money. Have a lovely life.
But nevertheless, F. Gary Gray, the director, who, of course, directed Ice Cube's star-making turn in the original Friday, which was a vehicle written by Ice Cube for himself. He directs this, and he does a wonderful job of, I think, making a movie that clearly appeals to and satisfies the initiated, but also makes the music and the people behind it accessible and understandable and appealing for the uninitiated.
Wow.
And that's a pretty nifty trick. But
that's a nifty trick.
112 million domestic in 10 days tells you that they've pulled off that trick. And it's fun to see a movie. And again, I try to learn as little as I can before seeing movies that I know I'm going to see. You know, just to come in as a blank slate. It's fun to be able to watch a movie and within a minute or 2 minutes know that my old collaborator, Matt Libatique, is the director of photography. Not because of credits, but because of knowing his work.
Wait, you recognize his camera work so much that you saw, that you knew right away, that's my old pal?
And his approach to the character, yeah. And understanding the rhythms of this and really using the music that they created as well as the time which he lived through and when he was becoming. This was when Matty was first becoming a cinematographer. All this was going on while I was in film school. And you knew it was by someone who remembers the era and uses it to really inform his approach.
Well, now, as a violence prevention specialist, I have to ask you what I'm reading about the whitewashing of Dr. Dre's abuse of his previous girlfriends. Did you notice that it was whitewashed? Did it seem clearly like they were brushing stuff under the carpet in this movie?
Well, he produced it, so there you go.
I see. And he sold his headphones to Apple for $3 billion. So I imagine that was the money financing it.
Honestly, I don't know enough about it. That's what I'm saying. I would call myself the uninitiated. You know, I was aware of NWA and their impact. I was aware of the rap wars because it is a uniquely Los Angeles kind of story. It is part and parcel of the late 80s and early 90s, not only culturally, but of race relations in this city. So I was aware of that. But in terms of the, if you were to tell me Dr. Dre had this litany of domestic violence, episodes through his history, did you know that, Phil Ernest? You know, my response would be a la Claude Rains in Casablanca. I'm shocked to find that there's gambling going on in here. I'm shocked to find that a rap mogul would express violence in his interpersonal relationship.
Wow, there you go.
But yeah, so I guess it is whitewashed. But I wasn't aware of it. What's my feeling about it? He produced it, so of course he's going to. Of course he's going to. So then I guess the question is, should the studio force a little more honesty? But also, what's the point of the movie, maybe? I mean, it does show what the violence intrinsic in this and how the business practices of the music industry lend themselves towards that kind of violence. And but at the same time, I guess it is whitewashed because Lily walks away going, I wish I could know Dr. Dre. He seems like a really nice guy.
Well, I would call that whitewashing then.
I guess that would be the if we looked up a definition of whitewashing in the dictionary, we would get a definition of whitewashing, which is what they did.
Yeah. Okay.
So, hey, you know, my summer of classic movies continues, and I saw two more Burt Lancaster movies, and I got to tell you, with each passing year, when I started making movies was about the time I started to really appreciate Burt Lancaster. Because this is an actor who doesn't go in for the big gesture. This is just a guy who roots a wide array of characters. And he grounds, he brings his own unique physicality to it, but grounds it in reality. So he did get to play such a versatile range. And the movies are always interesting. It can't be a coincidence that if Burt Lancaster's starring in it, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's so true. You think of that, he's what I would say he's got gravity, not even gravitas, just the gravity of a planet of a guy that the movie revolves around.
Oh, that's a really good way of putting it. He so the two movies that I saw, one of his early classics, Crisscross, which reteamed the creative group behind The Killers, which made him a star. And then I saw from 1977, when he was finally at the age where he had to turn to Roger Corman to keep getting work, as happens to everyone, the Samuel Z. Arkoff production of Don Taylor's version of The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Oh, and I've never seen that.
There's three versions of Dr. Moreau to date, of official versions. So many knockoffs, right. Obviously. There was an early one with Charles Laughton. The 90s one with Marlon Brando. But again, Lancaster's such interesting casting as Moreau, because as opposed to Laughton and Brando, who chewed up the scenery of an insane doctor like their lives depended upon it, Lancaster plays someone who believes in the importance of what he's doing.
Right.
So, is he mad? Maybe. Does he know right from wrong? Well, not as we would define it, but as he defines it.
Yeah. Think of how much more interesting that is as a choice, right?
So he is interesting. And his stuff in the movie is quite good. You know, the thing about Island of Dr. Moreau, the H.G. Wells story, is it's almost unfilmable because it's one of those things where the transformations... really require imagination to make them pop. Once you show them, no matter how good your effects are, it's either less scary, less mysterious, what have you. It could make for theoretically an interesting theatrical stage play experience because you could get away with leaving things unseen that you just probably can't in a movie. But big budget for a Corman movie, it was $6 million back then. And, you know, it wouldn't be too long before Lancaster, by doing that, by taking supporting roles in movies by major directors like Robert Altman, would very quickly return to leading man prominence in independent films like Louis Malle's Atlantic City and Bill Forsythe's Local Hero.
I know. Weren't those such great movies? And such a great way to end his career, too.
And of course, it did lead to some studio work again, because he got to do the big-budget Tough Guys with Kirk Douglas, which was, yes. You know, a summertime hit. And then, of course, what are considered, at least one that's considered a classic, which I think might have been his last movie, Field of Dreams.
Oh, of course, yeah. So I forgot he was in that, actually.
One of the reasons I wanted to bring up Lancaster, though, beyond these films, was he seems to really capture much of what I find myself lecturing about on a weekly basis in the acting classes that I've been teaching.
Oh, yeah. What's up with the students these days?
Well, I've really been working to crystallize what it is I look for in performances so that I can, break it down in a way that gives students, maybe not a process. I never want to give anyone a process. Everyone's process should be their own. And hopefully right. It's a process that should change up all the time. And it should be a process that reflects the reality of the character you're being called upon to play or the material. Right. That you're being called upon to perform, but I've realized that I look for five things, and when I find them, I really am transported into the world and the reality of the character I'm watching. The first.
So these are the Phil Fives, is that right?
I guess so. So
I see the book.
So I'm looking first and foremost for actors to embody the energy of the character.
Right.
It's amazing.
Physical embodiment, using their physicality to grab that energy.
Yeah. Yeah. That, so much of it, and I know you don't do this, but you must be aware of how many actors, even veteran actors, they begin with memorization and how to say the words.
Yeah.
And the truth is, if you embody the energy of the character, you don't have to worry about how to say the words. The energy will say the words for you.
That's true. That's right. That's an exuding. So that ultimately, the words are kind of irrelevant if you're encapsulated, because so much of our communication comes from physicality, body language, that sort of thing.
And that energy squeezing these words out, these expressions out. So the second is let that energy connect with the emotional reality of what the character is experiencing.
Right. That's a good one.
And then the third thing is to let that energy and let those emotions be affected by the physical surroundings.
And that's a good one.
Because let's face it, whether we're outside, whether we're in a club, whether we're going home, our energy and our emotional register is affected by whatever room of our house we're in. And that's sometimes the hardest one for actors to remember, because we don't force ourselves to be aware of that fact when we're walking through the world. But secondly, the reality, there is no reality of the surroundings in play.
Right.
Our surroundings are fake, man-made, imaginary, green screen, what have you. So you have to remember what your relationship to that space is and let that relationship affect your energy and your emotional reality.
Right. Playing the environment is often the term used in other acting classes. And that is really tough. Also on stage, when you're supposed to be in Castle Elsinore in Hamlet, but you're on just a bare stage and a black curtain. And to, like you said, have that not just physically affect you, but bring that reality of that castle existing has to be on the shoulders of the lone actor on stage standing there. And not just standing in a bare stage going, hey, look at me.
And we know when we see it. And if we see it, we therefore believe that that stage is that castle. It is that field. It is that starry sky. We believe that though Robert Redford is the most recognizable movie star on the planet, that he actually works in that cubicle in the Washington Post.
Yeah, for sure.
So
see it on his shoulders.
The fourth thing is let us glimpse the life that the character leads outside the story being told. I lecture about this all the time. Interesting acting involves not giving the scene too much, because let's face it, very rarely in our own lives do we recognize that a moment is important while it's happening. It's only in retrospect that it was important. We all have many things going on in our lives. So don't make any scene too precious. You don't have to make the stakes be what they are. The stakes are what they are. What you need to do is let us see that you've got a lot of other things going on in your life.
Right.
That's what makes a character three-dimensional. And
absolutely. And that, I'm reminded of a casting agent who said she liked when the actor, even though the scene end, would continue to act even though there's no more lines. So instead of just like dropping and standing there and looking at everyone going, what'd you think? They would still embody you know, they would be into their role so much that they would have this life beyond what the scene they were auditioning for. Same idea.
In a time when so much of television is procedural, this is the only way to make it not only fresh and interesting, but I think to maintain your sanity as an actor is to say what else is going on in their lives and play that even though you're not talking about it. You know, our friend David Dean Bottrell auditioned for one of those procedurals, and it was just a scene where he's an accountant or a bookkeeper at a bank, and he gives the information about someone embezzling, which leads to tracking down the killer, et cetera, et cetera. It's a thankless scene that's all about moving the plot forward. He goes in for a single audition. He says, how do I make this interesting? And he just decides, you know what? That morning was the morning my character's wife told him that she was leaving him. And that's what he brought to the audition. There was no second audition, no callback, nothing. He got cast immediately off a first audition. They said, do that. And that's how he played it, because he brought something real into the room.
Fantastic.
And finally, my fifth, be greedy. I'm looking for actors who are greedy. Greedy is not the same thing as selfish. In fact, I think in acting terms, to be greedy is to be quite generous. What do I mean by this? We remember moments. Just like in life, in movies, we remember moments. And so many of those moments we remember the best are, even in films rich with dialogue, are moments without dialogue where no one's speaking. And those are moments where the actor found something. They found something unexpected about how their character uniquely experiences and walks through the world, and they were greedy enough to explore it in that moment. And when you do that, it's generous to the audience, because this is our only chance to experience how that character walks through the world, how they interact with the world. And we might be moved by it, we might be inspired by it, we might be taught by it. So if you do not explore it and express it and share it, it will forever be unexplored, unexpressed, and unshared. So be greedy. It's to be generous with us. And the other thing is, quite frankly, in teaching these classes, I've found that it means to be generous with your scene partners as well, because it is really deepening the impact of what those other characters are doing and saying. It's showing how much those actions and words are have an effect.
Yeah, you know, and I would change the word greedy to have an appetite, because I would think then for it would involve all of those passions, both to be generous and also to fill your plate so that everyone can enjoy the picnic, as it were.
Yeah, that's a good, like, you, I mean, that is the always thing that I say. There are some people who never want to ask for more food when they're dinner guests, you know, and yet no host has ever been insulted by a guest saying, that was delicious, can I have more?
Right, exactly.
So that is a good point. But I use the word greedy intentionally, because, you know, so many actors will want to say, well, I don't want to be selfish, right? I don't want to take up so much space. No, be greedy. It is your space. Yeah. It is your time. Be greedy with it, and know that you're being generous with it. And know that a greedy actor is not the same thing as a selfish actor. A selfish actor wants to detract from others around them. A greedy actor wants to make the most of their space. So maybe there is a better word, but for now, I'll stick to it. So those are the five things I'm looking for. And why do I bring this up now? Because I realized that time in, time out, all five of these I'm seeing with Burt Lancaster. And so I encourage anyone who's interested in acting and interested in the art of acting, watch the movies of Burt Lancaster and see what I'm talking about. You may enjoy the movies. If not, you may deepen your own connection to how you go about your work, or how you appreciate the actors whose work you do love.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm going to look them up.
Hey, speaking of actors, you know, there was a Screen Actors Guild election this week. Did you vote?
Well, my ballots just came in the mail just the other day. So I don't think the turnaround would have made it in time to have made a difference. So, no.
There. It's really interesting because Ken Howard was reelected as president, which is largely a figurehead position. You know, the executive director, the national executive director, which is a hired position and is served right now by David White. That's the person with the real power, but they can be voted out of office. So this is why the elections matter. And it really was a split result. The membership first team, which opposed for so long a union merger, really made a comeback. And, you know, they'd been really irrelevant in union politics for quite some time. And now they've emerged again. And what was interesting about it to me was, you know, with a much larger membership now, there were, of course, more voters than ever before. But the percentage of votes cast was really, really small. And what's fascinating is how many people I've heard who are really shocked and dismayed by the outcome of the election and who didn't vote.
Oh, is that right?
You know,
shocked and dismayed and did nothing about it.
Well, because I don't think a lot of it was surprising to so many, the strides that membership first made. And I think it was because everybody seemed quite satisfied. Not everybody, obviously, but many people were satisfied with the direction the union was heading. They may say, okay, yeah, you know, we've got two different pension systems, but look, they merged the unions. Now let's let them have a chance to merge the pension system. Whatever it was, but it was this attitude of, okay, everything's moving in a reasonable direction. Let's see where it goes. And so they didn't vote. And they were suddenly struck by how the perhaps small minority that is upset with how things are being handled, those are the people that showed up.
It's always the way. Express your rage through the voting system. And those who are contented tend to sit on their hands, as it were.
Yeah, you know, just fatigue sets in, and so you don't vote. And you know, fatigue is clearly setting in. But in movies, you know, audiences do vote by failing to show up, and. Right. And they're voting about their fatigue, and as we've talked about with Ant-Man.
Ant-Man.
You know, being the least successful of all Marvel Cinematic Universe films, except The Incredible Hulk, which of course was attempting to reboot a franchise that had only begun just a couple years prior.
Right.
So we can say that this is the least successful of all the Marvel Universe films at this point. A fatigue factor is setting in, and we've talked about that, but I was sort of amused to see that it seems to be setting in within the offices of Marvel itself, where the on-again, off-again, on-again, off-again Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. spinoff that was set to star Adrian Palicki in her Bobby Morse character, it is now back on.
Okay.
A Mockingbird spinoff, which will also co-star Nick Blood playing Lance Hunter. But they are now saying that it, although it is back on again, it's not actually a spinoff.
What?
Yeah.
What?
So, and you know, but it is following characters who were on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But what I take this to mean from really reading through it is, they may be exhausted at trying to figure out how all these different pieces fit together.
See,
right?
That's the thing. Yeah, when you're plate spinning like that, eventually you just go, why am I spinning all these plates? And you let them drop and crash to the floor. That happens.
Why was Agent Carter refreshing? And why was Daredevil fantastic? Because to differing degrees, they actually told stories.
Yeah.
That people wanted to tell. So I get the sense that this is kind of them deciding, okay, we'll do this quote-unquote spin-off, but we're not going to try to shoehorn this in to the universe and to what's happening and to, you know, tie it into everything. Let's just follow these characters, tell a story, and if people respond to it, let's maybe keep having fun by deepening our exploration of those characters.
Yeah, right. See, I knew that it would eventually happen. This is, you know, when you start talking product locomotives, you you still have to have the fuel for that engine, and if it's runs out of steam, as it invariably will, all your boxcars start falling apart. I mean, it's a horrible way to do business because it just this very thing.
I hope that will be Sean Parker, who often posts about the show, that will be his favorite quote of the week. All your boxcars start falling off.
Exactly.
I'm so exhausted. All my boxcars are falling off. we had a great lawsuit of the week to talk about, but we'll save it for the opening of next week's show. Instead, I wanted, and it involves diversity, but I thought we'd set the stage, or the lack of diversity on television, which is something we talk about. But I wanted to say with you that, you know, we hadn't discussed this, but amidst the latest news about the X-Files revival casting, that specifically Vic Sahe, who played a Nerd Herd member Lester Patel in the cult series Chuck. You know, when I heard that news, it suddenly made me become aware of the fact that, at least from my vantage point on the outside looking in, there's been a real effort to bring great diversity to the X-Files this time around.
Oh, fascinating. I don't know if that's a conscious effort or not, but I agree that there is a larger, seemingly a wider net they have cast to see who comes in on this thing.
Because especially in its origin years, X-Files was very Anglo.
Well, yes. And I guess because you're out of Vancouver and,
right,
you know.
Right, and that changed, you know, with the inclusion of X and then with guest stars over the years. But I like that out of the shoots, there's a real, again, if it's conscious or not conscious, but there is a real diversity coming to the cast, not only with Mr. Sahe, but, you know, how about Kumal doing a guest star role?
Yeah.
Annette Mahendru from Homeland. I appreciate that.
Yeah, me too.
It's one of those things where you ask yourself, because there's two questions, right? Is it going to be good? But also, is it going to be relevant? And this helps you make something that's relevant.
Totally. I agree. And even, you know, my good friend Vina Sood is in this, who is a Canadian improviser that I've improvised many a time, Canadian Pakistani. So I'm glad she's also cast in the revival. All my friends getting in on the show.
But that's great. Yeah, I did not know about that, but that's fantastic. And again, the background. So not only the diversity, but the background of, you know, bringing innately entertaining performers to it. Because these ones we've just described are all, like yourself, they bring an innate entertainment value to something. And which, going back to what I said about acting, also looks a lot like bringing an outside life to a character.
Yeah, sure.
And so those are the kind of things that help make something relevant, you know, separate from whether the stories are good and whether they're well told. So that gives me, maybe I'm upgrading from guardedly optimistic to now genuinely hopeful.
Wow.
Hey,
we now have an upgrade.
Television lightning round, since we're talking about this. I checked out one episode of Fred Armisen and Bill Hader's documentary parody series, Documentary Now, on IFC. And I will give a second one a view, since it's been picked up for a second series. But boy, the one I saw was really a disappointment. I might see their parody of Grey Gardens and see how that plays out.
Right.
I never made it through IFC's The Spoils Before Dying, which is, you know, a comedy series that all-star cast, and I couldn't make it through that. I mean, it made me chuckle sometimes, but it just wasn't enough. But you know who did walk off with every scene she was in was the phenomenally talented Maya Rudolph. I don't know if there's many more gifted performers than Maya Rudolph who are just Absolutely. They delight you every single time you see them. So it was quite joyous news for me to hear that not only was her proposed weekly sketch comedy musical variety series sent to a series order, but joining her as a co-star in this weekly sketch and a musical variety series is Martin Short. So
wow.
It's the Maya and Marty show. And so it turns out their performance together on the 40th anniversary special of Saturday Night Live this last year was really kind of setting the groundwork for it. And I got to tell you, Martin Short, who's you got to be 70 years old, you know, I've been seeing some of his performances lately, like on the AFI tribute to Steve Martin. He is so at the top of his game.
I know, right? And still bringing in that energy. Like, it's as if he's still doing SCTV in the 1980s.
Talk about joy and elan, and that gives him an effortlessness, while at the same time, he's combining it with this old pros grace that he has.
Yeah.
It's terrific. And even as a dramatic actor, you know, like his turn in Inherent Vice really made that film come to life.
Yeah, for sure. I can't say enough good things about that guy.
So I'm really looking forward to that. And it's been a long time, I think, since we've had a weekly primetime variety show that really, again, felt relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what I picked up on a binge watch accidentally and was blown away by the performance? Are you watching? Well, I know you're not, because it's The Killing, which is following a killer through Seattle. It's dark, it's moody, but holy smokes, Peter Skarsgård as the wrongly convicted death row inmate. I mean, his scenes are basically him in a chair behind a glass on the phone in close-ups. But talk about a guy bringing it, and how you said having a full life and having so much more. This was a performance that has to get at least an Emmy nomination for this guy. It was stellar. It was amazing. And I can't say enough good things about it.
This is The Killing.
The Killing, yes.
Hey, isn't that a remake of a Scandinavian show?
I think it might be. It has that feeling. I haven't seen the original Scandinavian one.
And isn't this a few years old now, The Killing?
No, I think this third season is rather fresh, maybe 1 year old.
Okay.
The first two seasons, a couple years old, it stopped, and then they got the money together and a green light to do the last season, and that's the one that has Peter Skarsgård in it, and it's stunning.
Well, we are well over time, Dean Haglund, so why don't you tell people how they can find every installment of Chilpack Hollywood Hour?
You can find so many at chillpackhollywood.com, spelled C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com. You can subscribe, you can stream it, you can listen to us on iTunes even.
And, of course, all those episodes are hosted by the good people at Blog Talk Radio. You can find all new episodes on Stitcher and at Fanboy Nation. People can write us, Dean.
Yes, they can. At Dean or ChillPackHollywood at yahoo.com.
Yes, you don't
follow us on.
Well, we already told them how to follow us on Twitter. But we should also remind them that ChillPack Hollywood Hour is brought to you all by the good people at Empire State Gas. It's organically grown. It's good for you. It's good for the environment. Empire State Gas, from farm to pump. We've got great gas. Till next week, Dean Haglund. I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund, down under. See, there's the joke that should have worked. Oh, well.
All right. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye.
Belated spoiler alert.